Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals by Interactive Television. We have one matter on for hearing today, and that is State versus Vylan Dakota Anderson. This case was continued from January 23rd, I think, or somewhere around there. One of counsel had a car accident that day, and it was rescheduled accordingly. Was that you, Mr. Fessler? Or excuse me, Mr. Kettner?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Are you okay?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, I remember the day. It was roads and everything were not good, so I'm glad you're okay. Where are you at? Are you in the Blue Earth County Courthouse?
Yeah.
And is Ms. DeVos there with you?
She is here in the room with us.
Okay. You will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. When you begin your comments, give us your name and the party you represent. I know that now, but we need it for the recording. Whenever you're ready.
Very good. My name is James Kidner, and I represent Vylan Dakota Anderson. The state cannot hold Vylan Dakota Anderson to criminal liability where knowledge of the facts that would make a person guilty are absent. In this case, the district court specifically found that Vylan Dakota Anderson did not know the residence of her protected party, and we are here on appeal for a violation of a harassment restraining order. The same district court that held the trial had issued against Vylan Dakota Anderson a harassment restraining order prohibiting him from, among other things, being within 100 feet of a residence. However, in that order, the residence address was confidential. So Mr. Anderson received notice of a court order prohibiting him from being within 100 feet of an address which he did not know where it was.
If I can just interrupt, Mr. Kenner, there's a little bit of delay, so this is always a little bit awkward. He agreed to the entry of the order, though, correct?
He did stipulate to the order, Your Honor.
And the order, as it was issued, did not identify the location of where the protected person was residing, correct?
That is correct.
Should we infer anything from the fact that he didn't raise that question when he agreed to the order?
Your Honor, I don't know that. Short answer, no. I don't know that we can hold him to knowledge that it was not shown that he possessed. And in Mr. Anderson's mind, looking at this order, saying, look, I will stipulate to this because I don't want to harass this person. If this person wants no contact with me, that is just fine in my mind. And I will not make contact with her, whether in general public, they went to school at Mankato State University together. I will not make contact with her at Mankato State University. They had the potential to have classes together. The classes were rearranged. Ms. Buckley, the protected party, and Mr. Anderson both took steps with the university's assistance to help avoid further contact. And in Mr. Anderson's attempts, he did nothing more than attempt to live out his normal student life.
Right. All of those examples that you just gave are things that he would have known. That is, he would have known if she was in his class, he would have known if he was talking to her, he would have known if he was harassing her. What about that address thing? Why does he agree if he doesn't know where the location is?
Your Honor, it was a bad decision on his part. I think it was improperly agreeing to that order. But in agreeing to that order, the order was given first ex parte, and the initial order excluded him from Mankato State University entirely. Did not mention that he was a student. The petition did not mention that he was a student in seeking the order. So here we have a student who looks at last year, the senior year of his college experience. He's from California. He moved to Minnesota to live in Minnesota to get a degree, and he was excluded from getting that degree when he could see the finish line. This was his senior year of college, so a year that's supposed to be fun, entertaining, insightful, a learning event, a year in which students sort of spread their wings and fly.
Right, but we're dealing with the order that is before us now, not the initial one, right? So that was changed so that he could go to school. Can you tell me, is there anything in the record? I understand what the district court found, but is there anything in the, does the record tell us whether the other party moved from the address that was where she was at the time, that confidential address in the order was issued?
Judge Smith, the record is void of that. Best we can tell, she moved into that residence the day the order was granted, because she was not from Minnesota either. She's from Wisconsin.
And why do you say that that's the best you can tell, if it's void on that? What are you drawing that from, that she moved in that date?
The first date where students could move into that apartment complex was August 1 of a given year. So she cannot have lived there before August 1. Those apartments at Island Hills are empty, as far as we can tell. Mr. Anderson and Ms. Buckley had looked at apartments in that area together, in fact. But the students are not allowed to move into that residence until August 1 of the school year. And so she could not have been there before August 1. Whether she moved a different address, the defense doesn't know, but the record does not speak to that.
Well, wasn't August 18th the date of the harassment restraining order?
I believe that was the date the harassment restraining order was issued as amended.
Right. That was the date. It would have been on or about that date that he agreed to the order that we're talking about here today.
Correct. And if he went to the court to amend or modify the order solely because he was worried about not being able to be on campus at all.
Right, but if it's an August 1st move-in date, then she very well might have lived at that same address 18 days later.
Beginning August 1, correct. So it's very possible that she lived at the address, the confidential address, on August 1 and on August 18th. In fact, we believe that she moved into the residence August 1, but we don't believe that Mr. Anderson knew, and the court specifically found that Mr. Anderson did not know what the address was. And so he agreed to the modification and the harassment restraining order as amended because the first priority in his mind was, I need to be able to go to class. I need to be able to finish out my college years.
Counsel, can I ask you a question about what it is, then, your argument that the state has to prove? Does the state have to prove that, in your view, that the defendant actually understands how far 90 feet is? You know, what if is that a burden of proof that a person who's subject to a harassment restraining order actually appreciates a distance?
No, that burden is not on the state, because that is discoverable. Anyone can find a ruler, a tape measure, take a survey, and find out exactly where 100 feet is. But he can't go look up where a protected party lives if the address is confidential. So we can find from a given point how far away 100 feet is, but if we don't know that given point, there's no way to discover where 100 feet is. We're essentially just saying it could be anywhere. And that's the issue. That's the issue that Mr. Anderson is appealing, essentially.
There's
no way for him to discover.
Okay, so if the rule, I'm trying to figure out what rule you're asking us to, you know, hold in these cases. So if, for example, the state had proved that at the point that the HRO was issued, that he knew what the address was where she was living, that would have been sufficient if that were proved beyond a reasonable doubt. At that time period, at the time the HRO was issued, he knew where she was living?
Yes, if that were the case. We would not be here, because I believe that the state must prove that the defendant knew the facts or could reasonably discover the facts which would make his conduct guilty. So if the address was out in the middle of the country, for example, I wouldn't know where some random address is, but I could figure out where it is. So could Mr. Anderson. But the address was simply listed as confidential. That means anywhere. So he could be having lunch, he could be going to the store, he could be going, he knows what Ms. Buckley looks like, he knows what the protection party looks like, he knows if she's in class, he knows if he bumps into her in a hallway. There was an amended charge that we went to trial on that the state was alleging he was in on campus outside of class, and the court said, no, I think this is a public place. He can go to public, or a public event. I think he can go to public events by the nature of the order. So he can discover what a public event is. For example, a basketball game, a football game, some other graduation event, for example. But he still would not be able to approach Ms. Buckley. He still would not be able to approach the protected party. And what we're looking for here, Judge Smith, to cut to the chase, sort of, in what we're looking at is whether or not this criminal offense can be aptly characterized as strict liability offense, or whether it requires some knowledge, some sort of a general intent or specific intent. And I would concede this is not a specific intent charge. In fact, the legislature had created a specific intent charge in the gross misdemeanor and felony provisions, and then repealed and changed it to withdraw the specific intent charge. I believe that was a Gunderson, 812 Northwest 2nd, 156. But the legislature did not say no proof of knowledge is required. They did not make this a strict liability offense, and strict liability offenses, even for misdemeanor level, are disfavored unless it's a public policy matter. And this would not be a public policy matter. This doesn't involve hand grenades, such as in U.S. v. Freed, 401 U.S. 601.
I think the term you mean is public welfare offense, correct?
How should we determine
whether or not this is a public welfare offense?
I think the way to determine it is, does this offense affect the general public at large or specific members of the public? Even when we look at criminal offenses such as possession of controlled substance have an outside range affecting the whole public, but generally they only affect the people who are using them and related to the people. Even there, though, a person must know that the controlled substances are controlled substances. So a 10-pound bag of cocaine at the grocery store that's actually labeled as flour and looks like flour, and a person buys it as flour, does not suspect somebody to criminal liability where they don't know or can't discover that they just bought a 10-pound bag of cocaine. That does not set somebody up for felony criminal liability. I would argue the same kind of mens rea element applies in this case, that Mr. Anderson has got to have some way of knowing what he's looking at potentially violating. And it's simple to put this address, 401 South Broad Street in Mankato. Simple. It's simple to put Don't Be On Broad Street in Mankato within these four blocks. That's an area that's ascertainable, that's discernible, that even without knowledge of Mankato, someone can find out. We can look at maps. So obviously, the internet is very simple now to find out where a residence is. But what Mr. Anderson cannot find out without approaching Ms. Buckley, the protected party, or inquiring of the protected party's friends, classmates, relatives, hey, where does she live? And that to me sounds like he's been in the realm of following, monitoring, and stalking. And so either he's got to say, well, I don't know where it is, or he's got to suspect himself to even greater criminal liability by saying, I'm going to go follow her to find out where she is. And in this case, the state did not prove that Mr. Anderson knew where the residence was. So his non-criminal act, or what would be a non-criminal act, suddenly becomes criminal by no fault of his own. The case law speaks to, specifically Morissette, 342 U.S. 246, speaks to a vicious mind and a vicious heart. We can't have a vicious mind and a vicious heart when we don't know that our acts are wrong and have no way of finding out that our acts are wrong. I mean, it would be as if you're saying that prohibit him from being anywhere near within 100 feet of the protected party specifically. He doesn't know if she's on the other side of the wall. And so there's no way for him to ever be safe. He could be violating the order by being home.
Mr. Kuttner, I think that the I'm not sure if it's clear in our record, but I assume that the purpose of keeping her address confidential at the HRO hearing was to, for the purpose of not giving, from her point of view, I mean, her request and the court's granting of that request, I take it was to prevent Mr. Anderson from acquiring additional information that could potentially be used to have contact with her. So if we were to accept your argument and say that he could not be criminally prosecuted based on a confidential address, would it be possible for district courts to issue HROs that have that sort of protective feature?
Yes, Judge Johnson, and in my mind, it goes one of two ways. Either the respondent is informed of the address, which, again, which result I don't like, because the idea is to protect the petitioner. Or the court could ask, Mr. Responder, Ms. Respondent, do you know where this is? And if a person does not know, I don't think that they can be prosecuted unless the state says they would take on the additional burden of finding some way of proving that the respondent knew the address. For example, these are college students. If they had a get-together after class, for example, and Mr. Anderson went to the residence, obviously before the HRO was in effect, and you know went to the residence and met some people at the residence, oh, whose house is this? Whose apartment is this? Easy. Now we've got somebody who can come in and testify. Well, he was there. He knows whose apartment it is. There was an event at that house amongst him, his roommates that some of the witnesses spoke to. I see my time is almost up.
You can go ahead and complete the thought.
Thank you. So if there is somebody who could come and speak to the fact that the petitioner lived at that residence, or in another manner, if the petitioner drives a car and we know which car the petitioner drives and the petitioner consistently parks that car overnight, several nights in a row at a specific residence, at a house, for example, I think we could reasonably ascertain from that information that a respondent would know or have reason to know that that's where that petitioner lived. On the other hand, this is an apartment complex. There is no way to know or have reason to know.
No, not at all.
Counsel, the presiding judge has nicely let me ask another question. You referenced the situation of if a HRO says that someone can't be within 100 feet of someone, of a protected party, and they might be there, but they don't realize the person is there. Are you suggesting that the state in that situation, even though it's specific, you can't be within 100 feet of someone, that the state has a burden of proving that the defendant knew that they were within 100 feet of that person in that situation as well? In other words, your argument isn't limited to a situation where confidential address appears in the HRO, but...
Judge Smith, I think that's the correct sort of rewording of what I'm arguing here, and the idea being if they had some way of discovering that that person was in the next room. So, for example, I'm in a courthouse now, and if that person was a defendant in the courtroom next to me, well, I would know that I can't be within 100 feet of that courtroom because I know that defendant is there. If they're in for a family matter, same mm-hmm. idea. If they've got an appointment somewhere, if they've got class somewhere, same idea. They've got a way to know. So if I know that this person has class in room 302, and I go to room 301, which is right next door, I think at that point, if I were subject to that HRO, I would be in violation, and I would have a way of knowing that. Mr. Anderson had no way of knowing that.
Right, but you're suggesting that the state should have to prove that up in a case, that there would be reason that a person could have discovered, even within that 100, I'm trying to figure out within that distance, you can't be X distance, 100 feet from someone. The state, in your view, would have to prove up some circumstances that would show that the person must have been able to know or discover that the person was there.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
And before you start, Ms. DeVos, thank you for your accommodating Mr. Kettner and his regrettable situation back in January. It was helpful to us to still have oral argument here. We're doing it by ITV, but your accommodating approach to that problem is appreciated.
Thank you, of course.
Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Susan DeVos, and I'm Assistant Lowry County Attorney, and I'm here today appearing on behalf of the state. We are asking the court to affirm the district court's decision convicting Mr. Anderson of a misdemeanor violation of an HRO. This court is asked to do some statutory interpretation here, and as the court's aware, that's a de novo review by this court. If a statute is unambiguous, as it is in this case, they apply the plain meaning. In this case, the statute says that when a restraining order is granted and the respondent knows of the order, violation of that order is a misdemeanor. So there is a knowledge element, it's knows of, but there is no modification of unknowingly by it. It's not a knowing violation.
Doesn't the case law, such as Nitticum and other cases, do some further analysis that sort of goes beyond statutory interpretation? I mean, the case law says that mens rea is usually presumed, strict liability is disfavored, and that the legislature has to be clear in stating that an offense is a strict liability offense. Isn't all that true? And, but the statute of offense in this case was unchanged, right? It's paragraph 6B?
That's correct. At that time, the misdemeanor statute read slightly different from the gross misdemeanor and the felony statute. Well, they're all within the same statute with the subdivision, and they were changed so that they all match. So in this case, there is that element that you didn't need to know of the HRO, so it's not as if an HRO can be issued against someone and they don't know there even is an HRO. That would be a violation of the statute. But in fact, someone needs to be served. And in this case, he was served and he actually executed his right to appear at a hearing. He asked for the hearing, had the hearing. At that time, he stipulated to it with the amendment allowing for him to have some, be able to attend his classes at MSU. So he certainly had the knowledge that there was the HRO in existence. He had the opportunity to ask additional questions, and in fact did that, in fact asked to have it modified, and that was granted. So at that time, he certainly could have raised and requested that he have at least basic knowledge of where he could go within the MSU campus.
So is your argument that this offense is a public welfare offense? Do you have a citation for that, that feature about confidentiality?
And I apologize, Your Honor. I could get that to the court if the court would like. I know that it is a provision within the statute, and I don't think that that's a dispute. In fact, Mr. Kittner conceded that, I believe, in his brief.
Right, but I couldn't find it in 609.748 or 749. Anyway, we'll keep looking. Thank you.
Okay. I apologize. And if the court would like to supplement that, I didn't realize that would be a dispute. But I know that that is part of the provision that a confidential address can be included in an HRO, and that is has never been disputed in this case.
Wouldn't it be possible to maintain the confidentiality of the particular address but still impose some geographic restriction? Like, for example, if an HRO said the respondent shall not enter the space between First Street and Second Street and Elm Street and Maple Street, to have some geographically defined block or series of blocks, and then the respondent wouldn't know precisely where the complainant lived, but if the respondent avoided that geographic area, then the respondent would know where he could be and where he could not be. Wouldn't that be workable?
That could be workable, and in fact, that could have been a request of respondent at that hearing. He did not make that request. The other piece of this is a number of folks that apply for an HRO may move before that expires, and as we know, they are issued often for 1 year, sometimes 2 years. In this case, it was a year. There's nothing restricting the petitioner from moving, and they don't have to provide notice to the respondent of their new address in that circumstance. So somehow we're turning the burden onto the petitioner to keep the respondent apprised of the address.
Well, that example seems especially troubling. If I'm the respondent in a harassment restraining order, I'm told to stay 100 feet away from the person's residence, but I sort of have an idea where they reside. But then without my awareness, they move in down the block from me within 100 feet. Boy, it doesn't seem like I'm violating the restraining order without at least having knowledge that there's some chance that they moved there.
That's true, Your Honor. But again, the statute does not require that they know that you moved. My reason for that explanation is that there are examples in which, in this case, it's a confidential address, but even if it had been the specific address at the time, if she had changed her address, the burden isn't on the petitioner to make sure that they know the change.
But there would no longer be a violation if the person is near the new address. Unwittingly. I mean, that's the thing. If you have the address in at the start and then the person moves unbeknownst to the respondent, next door to the respondent won't be charged with violating the HRO, right? It's not putting a burden on the person to let the other respondent know, but they unfortunately, may find that the respondent is near them then. Do we need, in order to conclude that there's no mens rea requirement, do we need to, in your view, decide that it's a public welfare statute, or is there another analysis that would lead us to conclude there's no mens rea requirement?
No, I don't believe that this court has to find that it's a public welfare case in which to do that. This court certainly can look at that it's a case in which it's reasonable for the defendant to discover the facts as one option. And those aren't necessarily the only avenues in which the court could find that this is a case in which that specific mens rea is not required. Those are just the ones that have been specifically outlined by prior cases. Certainly, this was something that the legislature considered when they struck the language knowingly from the statute. And they didn't leave it in there. In fact, they could have expanded and added knowingly to the misdemeanor portion. They didn't do that. Instead, they required that the person knows of an HRO. So again, you have to have knowledge of the HRO. You can't be convicted of a violation of something you didn't even know was in place. In this case, he knew this HRO was in place. If he had questions about what that entailed, he had requested a hearing. He had that opportunity. And he didn't take advantage of that if he had a question about that. He also knew that there was an issue with MSU, Mankato State, and that he had asked to have the HRO amended to allow that he attend that school. So he had some understanding of that she would be an MSU student and had been an MSU student. So certainly he was on notice that she might be in that area.
And how does his ability I'm trying to figure out analytically where does it fit in that he agreed to a confidential address. What does that mean to it being listed as confidential and didn't question it at that hearing? How does that fit into the analysis later as to whether there's no mens rea requirement for, I suppose, any prosecution under this subdivision we're talking about?
I don't think he agreed that her address could be confidential. The court ruled that her address could be confidential, but he stipulated to the issuance of the order.
Right. I'm sorry. Yes. Right. How does that factor into the later question of whether there's a mens rea requirement under this subdivision, the fact that he stipulated to that?
It goes to the fact that he knew that there was an HRO in place. So if there was any question of that level of knowledge, which is what's required by the statute, he was served with the initial HRO and then took advantage of his opportunity to have a hearing, so certainly had an opportunity then, saw the order that was issued after that and was aware of what had been previously issued, both of which included that confidential address language. So there was no hiding the ball here. He was fully aware that her address was confidential when he stipulated to the entry of the HRO.
Are you arguing that he should be treated differently from a person who, let's say hypothetically, at the HRO hearing objects to the confidential nature of the address, but the district court overrules the objection, issues the HRO anyway? I mean, is that person in a different position in a subsequent criminal trial than Mr. Anderson in this case?
Our respondent, in your example.
The hypothetical respondent.
That would have been.
Okay.
And in this case, our.
Well, let's assume the hypothetical respondent appealed the issuance of the HRO because of that issue, and it was affirmed by this court. And then later on, the respondent was prosecuted in a criminal case for violating the HRO. Is that person in a different position than Mr. Anderson?
He had requested that because he didn't know and had no ability to learn of that and ask for some parameters on that. In that circumstance, I think the statute still says what it says in terms of knowingly and doesn't include that modifier, that he's knowingly in violation of it. So in that case, Your Honor, he would still be in violation of the statute. But in this particular circumstance, if the court is looking beyond that and requiring that he have knowledge, in this case, he certainly had the ability to obtain some additional information.
I'm a little concerned about that, had the ability. If I'm a protected person under a harassment restraining order, and the order is issued in similar ways as this one, where it says the respondent shall not harass the petitioner, shall have no direct or indirect contact, including visits or phone calls, direct or indirect. It seems like having the respondent conducting surveillance on where I live sounds like it's stalking-type behavior and would actually itself be a violation of the restraining order.
And that would be true, Your Honor, if it was done after the issuance of the order. My point is, Your Honor, that at the time that order was issued, he was in the courtroom because he had asked for the hearing. If he had questions about what the parameters were, that was the time to raise those and could have said, I don't understand what that means, could have allowed for, as Judge Johnson had indicated, some geographical instructions within the HRO may have allowed for some limiting or at least some explanation as to what was included, or even if the judge flat out said that in this case I'm just saying that it's confidential, I'm not going to do that, at least he would have been on notice of that. But in this case he didn't ask for that, but knowing full well that the address was confidential. But he also knew she was an MSU student, so he had those parameters in mind.
It sounds like you're arguing that he, in some way, has failed to preserve his argument in this criminal case because of his actions or inactions in the HRO case. And I guess to follow up on Judge Smith's earlier question, I'm just wondering if there's any case law to that effect. And I mean, it appears you have not argued that in your brief. I mean, you haven't given us written argument, I think, about this theory of yours. Am I correct about that? Or in whether I'm correct or incorrect, I mean, what is the case law, or what are the legal doctrines that you're relying on?
Thank you. First and foremost, I'm relying on the fact that there's strict construction of the statute, because the court has indicated some concern with whether or not he could know of that address. That's where I went down the road of the knowledge piece of it, which the statute does require he knows of. But my point was that he knows of the HRO and certainly had knowledge and ability to object or raise concerns at that time. That's where it comes from. I don't have a specific case law. I don't believe there is any that specifically addresses this statute to that point.
Judge Rodenberg, could I ask one more question?
Absolutely.
Ms. DeVos, Mr. Kuttner cited in his initial brief the case In Re CRM. And you did not cite it in your red brief, and so I'm wondering if you have any response to it, and if you wish, I can review the basic facts for you.
Just one moment, Your Honor, if you would allow me.
Yeah. And maybe I can help by asking a more specific question. So I mean, in CRM, the offense was possession of a weapon on school property, the weapon being a 4-inch folding knife, which was otherwise innocuous. And the Supreme Court concluded that the state was required to prove both that the defendant knew that he possessed the knife and also that he was on school property. And the Supreme Court later distinguished that case in Benefield, which had to do with possession of drugs in a school zone. The Supreme Court distinguished that because possession of drugs is unlawful everywhere, whereas a folding knife, would be innocent conduct but for the location. It seems CRM is very analogous to this case. I mean, Mr. Anderson's mere presence in a neighborhood near MSU would be innocent conduct, not criminal. But his presence at maybe stated another way, his presence at an apartment complex simply walking through would not be criminal but for the location of the complainant's residence. Anyway, so it seems like CRM is supportive of appellant's argument. I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
CRM did deal with the case in which they were looking at mens rea and whether the child in that case, delinquent, whether he possessed a weapon and had knowledge of that possession on a school ground. In this case, I do think it's not exactly the same thing, and that this court has looked at other cases in which an individual had, for example, didn't know they were 300 feet from a house that they were not allowed to be by, or didn't realize that this is what the statute required. The statute didn't allow the individual to be by that person's house doing it. It was an unpublished decision by this court that I did cite in my brief.
Which one is that? Is that Hill?
State v. Hill, 2016.
I did read that. I think it's a sufficiency of the evidence challenge. I don't think there was an argument about mens rea, but I'll review it.
But I think in that case, Your Honor, they were looking at the fact whether or not the individual had knowledge and whether that was relevant, whether she knew that she wasn't allowed to drive, there were two pieces, if my memory served me correctly, didn't know for sure whether that was within 300 feet. And she also thought that the provisions of the HRO prevented her from just stopping and in front of the house and hanging around, I think is how it was worded, but driving by, she didn't know that that would be a violation. And this court said that it was, in fact, and even though she didn't believe that that was enough, that it, the statute just says she knew of and not that she knew it was a violation of, but that she knew of the HRO and, in fact, it was in place, regardless of whether the fact she knew that it was 300 feet or within the 300 feet, regardless of the, whether she understood that her actions were in violation of it, was still a violation of the statute. So I think that case is more analogous. Certainly the court has come out different ways with different statutes, but this statute specifically to invoke both the fact that it's unambiguous, and if the court wants to look beyond that, the legislative intent is clear here based on the case law and the legislative change.
Thank you, Ms. DeVos. Mr. Kittner, do you wish to respond?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Judge Johnson, I believe, spoke to legislative intent. And when I read Minnesota Statute 609-748, Subdivision 6B, there's a requirement of notice within that statute, notice of the arrest and restraining order. What I can't wrap my head around is why the legislature would require notice of an order if the order is unclear on its face. Why those two would jive together for the benefit of the state in this case. Because the legislature wants a person to know what behavior is criminal and what behavior is non-criminal. And in this case, we've got an arrest and restraining order that on its face cannot be discoverable. The facts are not discoverable to Mr. Anderson, to the respondent in the HRO petition, without potentially violating the petition itself and potentially without violating another subdivision or section statute of the law, 609-749, the stalking statute.
But I'm trying to figure out what you think the state actually needs to prove at every hearing at these. Because what if someone gets served with it? A harassment restraining order and says, I'm not reading this nonsense. Forget it. I just refuse to read it, which could happen, right? And then they go ahead and violate it. The order is clear on its face that it can't, that the person can't be at address X, and then they go to address X, and they hadn't bothered to read it. Does the state have to still prove up that person's knowledge? Or it seems to me that a lot of your argument is about some ambiguity or uncertainty about the order itself, which is resolvable in a different place, or maybe it's, I don't know, some due process challenge if there could be such a thing at the criminal trial or something. But it seems a little different from having to prove up the knowledge of the person at the criminal trial. What happens if someone just doesn't read it and certainly didn't know because they didn't read it?
Judge Smith, for a person to simply not read the order, in my mind, would not be sufficient to absolve them of liability for a criminal charge in a HRO violation, because the facts of the HRO are eminently discoverable. I couldn't find it. I believe there's a case out there that speaks to a non-English-speaking person was served with a harassment restraining order written in English and argued at the district court, and I believe on appeal, that this was written in a language I don't understand, therefore it doesn't apply to me, I don't know what it says, so I can't be violated on this, I can't be charged with a criminal. And the court, I think correctly, said, no, that's not the way this works, because you can go get an interpreter, and you can find somebody to say, this is what this means, this is what that means.
So is there a jury instruction that should be given with respect to mens rea in every case like this? And what would that jury instruction be then on that element to accommodate all of the different types of situations that we're talking about? Someone doesn't read it, or they don't bother finding out what it says if they don't speak the language, et cetera.
If this case was submitted to a jury rather than the court, I would have asked for a jury instruction that the state prove that Mr. Anderson knows of the facts that would make him guilty. So, for example,
where's the discoverability in that? How could a jury, what if he doesn't know, but he could have reasonably discovered it? It seems like that doesn't accommodate your idea of, no. You can't just ignore an HRO and you can't just not read it and get off because you don't know it that way.
Correct. He can't just ignore the idea of the HRO. But if the address said, for example, 401 Broad Street, and he doesn't know where that is, he could figure that out, and it wouldn't be very difficult. The state could simply ask a police officer, ask the petitioner, ask any one of its witnesses, do you know where that is? How did you find out? Well, somehow they went there, they looked at a map, something, but there's a way to find out. If the address is confidential and nothing speaks to where that address is, there's no way to discover it.
Well, that sounds more like a... That sounds more like a knows or should have known kind of element, what you're now describing.
But I think with the mens rea element, the way I read it, it's not necessarily knowledge of the law, because ignorance of the law is no excuse. It's
absolutely
knowledge of the facts that would make a person guilty.
But in the example, I think in Judge Smith's example, what if served with the ex parte harassment restraining order or domestic abuse restraining order for that matter. I mean, I signed a million of them, or close to that, when I was on the district court. I think the first thing some of these guys did was tear them up and throw them in the wastebasket without reading them. So did they know where they weren't allowed to be, or should they have known where they weren't allowed to be?
They would know or should have known, and it's not impossible for them to ask the court. Again, I see my time is up, if I may.
Well, I asked the question. I got to give you the time to answer it.
Thank you, Your Honor. In that case, it's, again, easily discoverable. The respondent in a case like that, the criminal defendant subject to the Danko, could very well ask the court, ask their attorney, what does this say? Ask a bailiff. You know, I just threw that away. That was stupid. I need to read that. Can I get another copy? And another copy could be printed, and there we are. So the facts in a case like that would be easily discoverable, that a person could be held liable, in my mind, in a case like that. But in a case like this, we have no way for Mr. Anderson to discover the facts that would make his conduct guilty. And that's why we're asking the court to reverse the district court order and hold for appellant Mr. Anderson.
Any additional questions? Okay, that concludes the arguments. I'm going to use my authority as presiding judge to order that the record be held open until 5 o'clock p.m. Central Daylight Time for either of counsel to submit any authorities, not argument, just authorities, statutes, cases, attorney general opinion, on the subject of the authority and the legal basis for including in an HRO this confidential address stuff. That was a pretty poor enunciation of what I'm looking for, but do counsel understand what I'm talking about? Find the statute that, or the rule or the case that says you can do what the district court in the HRO did here. That is to say, you're excluded from 100 feet from a confidential address. So we'll hold the record open until Friday at 5. Then the matter will be submitted as of 5 o'clock Friday, and that is all we have for today. Thank you to both of counsel for your briefing and argument.